He's one of the greatest football players ever to come out of Indiana University and one of the relative few who had the privilege of playing in the Rose Bowl. A Muncie native, he was one of the greatest athletes ever to come out of that city. He was the MVP of three different sports, both as a junior and senior in high school. And while he loved basketball best, he wound up focusing on football. A quarterback in high school, he was moved to tailback shortly before the season began his sophomore year at IU. But that wasn't the half of it. He punted, he returned kicks, he lined up as a receiver on occasion, and he threw the occasional pass as well. The Hoosiers had a miracle run that season, seemingly getting all the breaks along the way. They wound up in a three-way tie for first place with Purdue and Minnesota and got the invitation to the Rose Bowl for the game on January 1st, 1968. To this day, it remains the university's only trip to Pasadena. And let's face it, the way things are going, it's going to be a while before they go again. He went on to play in the NFL for the 49ers and a year in the World Football League before entering the real world. But all these years later, IU still hasn't had a more versatile player than he was. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with John Eisenbarger.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today's one-on-one conversation comes to you from the fifth floor studios at Emmis Communications, downtown on the Circle. We're here today with an IU football legend, and let's be honest, there aren't a lot of IU football legends. But this guy played on the Rose Bowl team way back when, and we got a lot to talk about, not only from that experience, but from beyond that as well. John Eisenbarger with us. John, we were just talking off the air. You're born in Muncie, but you didn't necessarily grow up in Muncie.
No, grew up in Chicago till high school, and my dad got transferred back to Muncie, and so I ended up graduating from Muncie Central High School.
Okay. Had your dad been an outstanding athlete?
He was. He was a good athlete. He played football, basketball, baseball, and then he played at DePaul and was captain of their team. And he might have played pro ball had he not been he left DePaul after his second year because of World War II and then went back and finished. But he had a tryout, had been invited to camp with the New York Giants.
Okay.
And he's in the DePaul Hall of Fame.
Yeah, what position?
He was a center and a linebacker.
A center, I'm guessing he weighed under 200 pounds in college.
He was probably close, but he was 6'4", probably 200.
Okay, well, that was big for his era then.
Absolutely.
A lot of linemen back then weighed 170 or something like that.
Right.
So, okay. Right. So you graduated from Muncie Central in 1966?
That's correct.
1966. Yeah. Growing up, was football always your favorite sport or was it something else?
Actually, my favorite sport was basketball. And, of course, I played a lot of basketball in Illinois. I never played tackle football till ninth grade. They didn't play it in junior high back in those days. And so ninth grade in Muncie was my first year playing quarterback.
Interesting. So it seems like everybody I talk to, the sport they wound up playing and really succeeding in was not their favorite sport. You know, I mean, I had Austin Carr in your chair a few weeks ago, and he grew up, you know, baseball was his favorite sport. And I can go on and on. It's just amazing how that seems to work out.
Well, and I think basketball, too. I was not on a very good Muncie Central team. I led the North Central Conference in scoring that year, but we didn't play very well. But I think, you know, your talent shows up in basketball more than in football, just because there's only five guys out there and you need 11 on a football team.
Yeah, Muncie Central, obviously one of the hotbeds of basketball. They'd already won several state championships by the time you came along.
Right.
So if basketball is your favorite, at what point did you realize that football was going to be your future? You know, at what point in high school did you realize I'm going to really have to wind up playing football?
Well, actually, all my recruiting trips when I was in high school, I would also meet with the basketball coach because I was going to try to play two sports. And I did at IU. You could only play, you know, you couldn't play varsity sports as a freshman when I was down there. So you could, we had two games in freshman football and 10 games in freshman basketball. But the next year we went to the Rose Bowl, and so I came back. I was on the basketball team sometime in early January, and wasn't ready to play basketball then. And then my junior year, I had a knee operation, so that was kind of the end of my basketball career in college.
Okay. Do you think you could have played college basketball, I mean, and contributed if you'd been healthy and focused on it?
I was recruited to play basketball. I had Kentucky and Michigan, and there were some schools that were pretty good in basketball.
At what point, I mean, was it a difficult decision to play football instead of basketball? I mean, to concentrate on football?
You know, my senior year, Mike Phipps and I were the all-state quarterbacks, and Mike had decided to go to Purdue. And I'll tell you a little story. Jack Mullenkoff came to my house and sat in my living room with Bob DeMoss. And you'll have to talk to Leroy Keyes about this.
Okay.
The whole time he called me Mike. He said, Mike, you can start as a sophomore. Mike, we really want you to come. And Phipps had already committed to going to Purdue. And they left that day. And I turned to my dad and I said, Dad, I think Mike's got the deal at Purdue. Well, long story short, Phipps and I and Harry Gonzo and Jade Butcher and Tim Foley all played in the Hula Bowl, which was an all-star game after our senior year. And Coach Pont was there, and so was Jack Mullenkoff. Well, even in the Hula Bowl, he didn't call Mike Phipps by the right name or Tim Foley. So I told him that story, and they just said, well, he was just that way.
So if Mullenkoff had called you John, would you maybe have gone to Purdue? I mean,
Probably not. Yeah. Probably not. I really liked John Pont, and I had even gone over to Miami of Ohio. Of course, that cradle of coaches, and a lot of coaches have come from there. And somebody said, well, at Michigan, you were recruited by Bo Schembechler. I go, no, back then, Bo was at Miami of Ohio, and Bump Elliott was at Michigan. Mm-hmm. But I really like John Pont. I was an Indiana kid, and so it all worked out.
Yeah, we should, just to give due credit, you know, you were the most fabulous player in all three sports as a junior and senior, right?
In high school.
High school.
Yeah.
And you were fourth in the state in pole vault?
Actually, third.
Third. My bad. Yeah. How high'd you go?
13-6.
Yeah? That's great.
I went 14 once, but fiberglass pole had just come in, so I really wasn't – I didn't know how to rock back and get the spring out of that. So I was just – you know, you just ran down and planted it and swung yourself up.
You go to Indiana because you like John Pont. You know, Indiana football was nothing then. I mean, you know, under Phil Dickinson had gotten put on probation. The entire athletic department was basically on probation because of that. Indiana had gone 1-8-1 in 1966, and you still go there. So you must have really liked John Pont. I mean, was it the opportunity for playing time, or was it just all because you liked him so much?
Well, of course, you never know when you go to college. You come, you know, everybody's an all-state guy when you show up at a Big Ten school. You've been all-state somewhere because you're recruited. But I just, you know, I like the program. I like Pont. And, you know, it was really luck of the draw with who he had coming in there. Back then, you didn't have these recruiting, you know, you can go on the internet now and see these 5-star, 4-star, 3-star recruits. And back then, you didn't even know the guys that were in Ohio or Illinois or Michigan that were coming to the school till you got there.
Let's talk about the Rose Bowl year. I mean, that's still magical in the history of Indiana football. It seems to me, and we'll kind of get into detail on it, but it just seems like one of those seasons when everything went your way. You got all the breaks that could be had. The ball kind of bounced your way. Do you still see it that way looking back on it? Or?
We won a lot of games in the fourth quarter. You know, I was recruited as a quarterback, and my freshman year, Harry Gonzo and I were the quarterbacks, and 10 days before our sophomore season started, Pont moved me to tailback. He said, well, I got to have both of you playing, and you got to, you know, you're moving a tailback. Well, I had run a lot as a quarterback in high school, but tailback in the Big Ten was a little different animal. I had watched Indiana play Michigan State, and Michigan State, when I was a freshman, was national champions that year with Bubba Smith and George Webster and Gene Washington and Clinton Jones, and they absolutely destroyed guys on the IU football team that year. And I'm sitting in the stands, I'm thinking, so this is what it's going to be like next year.
The Hoosiers put together the most miraculous football season in school history, despite Eisenbarger's reluctance to punt the ball. when One-on-One continues. But first, here's IU coach John Pond showing highlights of IU's season-ending win over Purdue, with Eisenbarger making a catch from quarterback Harry Gonzo.
Not too much on the first down. We're now second down and 8. Gonzo throwing, John Eisenbarger, a beautiful catch. The ball is laid out perfectly. John runs down and gets inside the 5-yard line.
Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former IU football star and Rose Bowl participant John Eisenbarger. IU had a great team in 1967, but it had a lucky team too. Here's the rundown to the Rose Bowl. Like the opener, you guys played Kentucky. You won it 12-10. Gonzo threw a fourth down 23-yard pass to Al Gaze that was deflected into his hands for a touchdown. I mean, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. Then you beat Kansas 18-15 on a field goal,
right,
by a guy who wasn't your regular kicker, but there had been an injury, I guess, to the regular kicker. Then you beat Illinois 20-7 after Brown Marks, the linebacker, caused a first down fumble in the fourth quarter. You know, this is the kind of thing we're talking about.
I even fumbled on the goal line going in against Illinois, and Rick Spickert fell on it, who was a tackle on our team, and that's how we scored one of our touchdowns.
Yeah. And then the next week against Iowa, and this is kind of where John Eisenbarger starts gaining his fame, you ran from a punt formation on fourth down and failed. And Indiana was able to come back and win the game in the final minute. You know, the whole thing became, you know, punt, John, punt. You know, you had a way of not punting and trying to run for a first down. And I, from what I can tell, it was just your own idea that you weren't told to do this, right?
Well, and you know, there was the next episode against Michigan.
But yeah,
actually, there was a play that we had because I was the punter, and we'd watch film, and Iowa actually, one time in that game, I ran and made a first down, but it was a planned play. Because their front line would hit, and then they would turn their backs and run back like it was going to be a return. And so I just ran straight up the field behind them and made a first down. The next time, I kind of made my own decision to do that. And, you know, John Pont used to call us free thinkers back then, and sometimes we were thinking a little too much.
Yeah, this is the psychedelic era, right? Free
right.
love and all this kind of thing. And the Michigan game, you're on your own, what it says, 13-yard line, and you tried to run, and it didn't work, and Michigan scored, and Indiana had to make a game-winning drive in the last couple of minutes. In this, I guess that was the third time that you decided to run on your own. Supposedly, you ran over to punt one time and say, "Coach, why do I do these things?"
Yeah,
is that true?
I don't remember that, but you know, that's what
it's
it
a good story.
Yeah, it is a good story. Yeah, and fortunately for me, I went in and I don't know how much. I think I gained the last 50 some yards and scored the winning touchdown. So it was kind of the goat to hero game for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I may never have played again if we'd have lost that game.
Is it true that fans used to chant "Punt, John, punt"?
Well, you know, I never saw this, but supposedly before the Arizona game, my mother had sent
a telegram
that said "Punt, John, punt" or whatever. So it
became,
it was part of that season.
Yeah. Do people like still today who know who you are say "Punt, John, punt"?
Once in a while, yeah. You've got to be pretty old to remember that, though.
It lives today. But I'm guessing that, like, after you went to the Rose Bowl and all that, while you're still on campus, or even after you graduated, were gone, that you must have heard that a lot.
Yeah.
It just became a thing, didn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was. And, of course, there was a nice article in Sports Illustrated about it, and that kind of gave us some national press.
I went back and read that. Yeah, it was a good article. Somebody came in during that year. And like I say, it was a magical year. Again, if you know the history of Indiana football, imagine a team winning all these close games and going to the Rose Bowl. Looking back on it, do you wish you had played quarterback in college, and do you think you could have played it in the NFL?
You know, the only one time I played quarterback in college was when Harry got hurt, and so did the backup, Mike Heisman. at Northwestern, and I played quarterback for maybe a quarter. I threw one touchdown pass. We got beat, I think, 30-28. It was a close game. But, yeah, I probably could have. And I was probably the third quarterback on the 49ers. If Brody went down and Spurrier went down, I could have, you know, taken the ball and handed off. And I threw a lot of halfback passes in college.
Yeah, I was going to say, they used your passing abilities a lot anyway. So yeah. It kind of worked out. So you guys are 8-0 that year. You lose at Minnesota 33-7. You come back to play Purdue. You know, which is equally good at the time. Games in Bloomington, Purdue was third in the country. You guys won that game 19-14, even though you were a 14-point underdog. What do you recall from that game? I mean, that has to be the best Bucket game of all time.
Well, and we had to win that game to have a shot at going to the Rose Bowl, which was really strange back then. And I don't know why this rule was, but Purdue had gone to the Rose Bowl the year prior. And for some reason, the rule was you couldn't go 2 years in a row. I mean, now if you're 6-6 in your record, you know, 7 or 8 teams out of the Big Ten will go to bowl games.
Yeah.
But Minnesota, ourselves, and Purdue, after we beat Purdue, we're all 6-1, and we got voted to go because I think Minnesota had been prior, I don't know, way back they had been. But, you know, that game was, Terry Cole, who was our fullback, had two – amazing runs, and they were just straight up the middle handoffs, and the timing was right, and that was probably his best college game ever. I think he, gained 160-some yards that game. And
he had a 63-yard touchdown run late in the first half.
And then another one, didn't he?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Purdue had 4 turnovers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you
go ahead.
And I was going to say, did you know when that game ended you were going to the Rose Bowl? Because my impression was you had to wait a while to find out.
We did. We had to wait a while. We had to wait. And Purdue and IU is such a rivalry. But back then, the president of Purdue was Dr. Hovde. And he came in our locker room and congratulated everybody, which I thought was really a great, great thing.
What's it like on campus that night when you find out you're going to the Rose Bowl? Must have been bedlam.
Yeah, it was. They weren't turning cars over or anything like they do now. I think they jumped on the goalpost. I think they tore the goalpost down.
Yeah.
I don't know if you see that so much anymore, but that was a big deal for people to rush out. And, you know, the stadium was packed back then. I think, 53,000 is all mm-hmm. that it held back in those days.
And, yeah. So you go to the Rose Bowl to play USC. You don't win the game. I think it was, 14-3?
Right.
Yeah. What do you remember, though, from the Rose Bowl experience?
Well, we got stuck on the people mover in Disneyland. and Lowry's always had a deal about which team ate the most beef.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
So we'd go, and it was called the Beef Bowl. Southern Cal beat us at that, too. But, I don't know, we played against O.J. Simpson. The main thing back then was we didn't play against him, and you didn't see, we saw film on him, at the end of the year. They had 5 first-round draft choices, and O.J. was a junior. They had Ron Yeary, Earl McCullough, Tim Rossovich, Adrian Young, and their fullback, Hall. Those were all 5 first-round draft choices, and O.J. was a junior. And there were other guys, Sandy Durko, my class ended up playing for the Bengals. There's a lot of people that play at SC that go into the pros.
Yeah.
But I took the opening kickoff and had a pretty good opening and actually slipped as making a cut.
The referee, Eugene Calhoun of the Big Ten, signals we're ready for the boot. And Tim Rossovich, the big boy at 235 pounds, moves forward. We're underway. It's high and deep. Coming downfield, it's Eisenbarger on the 90. He's at the 10, straight ahead to the 15, wide of the 30, 20. He slips and falls on the 25-yard line as Pat Cashman fell on top of him. And it's a run back from the 9 to the 25-yard line, 16-yard return as sophomore John Eisenbarger of Muncie, Indiana, has the ball for the first time in the 1968 Rose Bowl game.
The Rose Bowl back then played a lot of games. Pasadena Junior College played there. There were high school games there. So when you see it on TV, it's all painted up great, but a lot of that was not grass.
Oh.
And so, we're talking about, 1968 Rose Bowl. We didn't, we weren't, The only AstroTurf I ever played on back then was at Michigan State, and I think the president of Monsanto gave that field to Michigan State. So we really didn't, you didn't have the artificial turf back then.
The artificial turf you did have was terrible. I mean, it was like the kind of stuff you put on your back patio or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was a layer of asphalt and then a little carpet pad and then the, because I've been, I've been in the in Lucas Oil Stadium now in that stadium, and that AstroTurf is actually pretty soft to be on.
I mean, much different.
You can walk on it, and it's got a nice cushion to it.
Yeah, so the Rose Bowl didn't work out, but still, okay, you're coming off your sophomore year. You've been to the Rose Bowl. You must be thinking, hey, this is going to be – it might be like this every year, right?
Well, yeah, you would hope so. And then, of course, it sure helped recruiting. My junior year, I tore my thigh muscle before the season started, so I didn't play against I don't know if the first game was Kentucky or not. I know then I came in and played the second half against Kansas, and then I blew my knee out against Michigan State up there and missed the last three games. So the junior year was not quite a
– You guys finished 6-4.
Right.
And then your senior year, you go 4-6.
Yeah. And our senior year, actually, Look Magazine had us number one in the nation.
Because, really?
Because we this preseason, because they said, well, you got all these sophomores back. They ought to be going to the Rose Bowl again.
IU didn't go back to the Rose Bowl for Eisenbarger's senior year. We'll see why when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Eisenbarger taking the pitch for a 14-yard gain in the third quarter of the Rose Bowl.
High formation. Gonzo sprints out to the left, pitches back to Eisenbarger up to 25, to 30. He cuts into the 35, and he's rolled to the ground at the 38-yard line. John Eisenbarger, one of the sensational Indiana sophomores, got loose for 14 yards from the 24 up to the Indiana 38-yard line. He was finally brought down by the left corner man, Bill Juroncic, and the Trojan safety man, Mike Battle.
About to play the beat Michigan State, Mike, and Eisenbarger needed one more block, and he might have gone all the way.
That was Indiana's longest run from scrimmage, 14 yards.
Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former IU football star John Eisenbarger. There were high hopes for IU's football team for his senior year in 1969, but this was during the peak of a lot of social unrest, and some of the team's black players boycotted. That led to a disappointing season, but it didn't keep Eisenbarger from getting to the NFL.
That was an interesting year. I mean, we had a boycott at IU, and that was kind of going on throughout the country. And as I sit here back then, I don't remember any dissension or anything on our team that would have caused that internally. I think it was all outside influences that happened.
Yeah.
It was the times.
It was the times. Like in 68, we'd had the Olympic boycott. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, obviously the Black Power movement was in full swing, and not to say that there wasn't a need for it or a reason for it, but I was going to ask, how did it affect the IU football team specifically, like that year? Did guys leave the team, or what was going on?
Well, I think the black players were influenced, and they were told, they said they didn't come to practice one day. And the coach, John Pont, said, if you don't come back the next day for practice, you're going to be off the team. Well, three or four of them came back. John Andrews, I can't think of everybody who did, but, most of them, and probably six of them, were starters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that affected our ability to win anymore that year.
Sure.
I think at that one time we were 4-1 and we lost the last five games.
Okay. So a lot of guys were just off the team, just left the team.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What was your communication like with them? either then or after the season ended, or even if it's today. I mean, do you guys ever talk about that? Like, what was going on? What were you thinking?
You know, we've had Rose Bowl reunions. It used to be every 10 years, and now we do it every 5 because we've lost some guys off that team that have passed away. So we're doing it every 5 now. And it, you know what? If you ask both people now what was the reason, they would just say it was the times. There was nothing on that team that, you know.
Nobody had a grievance against Pont.
No. Yeah. Now, I think people made things up because something had to be made up because guys got, you know, kicked off the team for not coming back from practice.
Were you bitter? You had to be angry about that, you know?
You know, I don't remember. I think we just kept playing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, you know, we weren't going to forfeit games. So, you know, we just went out and did the best we could.
You were depleted, to say the least.
Though. Right.
And I would imagine for the black players who did come back, that had to be a difficult decision for them. You know, they were probably catching a lot of hell from other people, you know, by doing that.
Back then, you would have, you know, 1968.
Of course. But they want to play pro ball. They got their careers to think about.
Right.
So it ends not too happily, but you're a second-round draft pick of the San Francisco 49ers, and you're a running back in the NFL for a couple of years. You got to be one of the last white running backs in the NFL. Is that true?
I think so. I think I saw Toby, what's his name? Toby, anyway, he's a running back on the Vikings that plays by Adrian Peterson, and he was at Stanford. Toby Gearhart.
Yeah, that's right.
That was, I played running back a couple years, and then I was a wide receiver a couple years. And then went to the illustrious World Football League.
Yeah.
In Hawaii.
Yeah. You threw a 48-yard pass for the 49ers one time. You scored 2 touchdowns, right?
Right.
Do you, like, all these years later, do you remember the touchdowns?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the one was about a 64-yarder from John Brody, and then another one was when Spurrier was playing quarterback.
Did you like your time with the 49ers? I mean, were you happy?
It was wonderful. It was really good. I just got back a couple weeks ago from they honored our 71 team that played in Candlestick because we were the first 49er team to play in Candlestick. My rookie year was in Kezar. And so they honored our team because this is the last year that they're playing in Candlestick, and they're going to be moving to Santa Clara to Levi Stadium down in Santa Clara, which actually is where the 49ers have their training camp and offices now. And so that was great. I saw guys I hadn't seen in 40 years. I mean, I saw Brody and Dave Wilcox and Charlie Kruger and Kaz Banaszak played at Northwestern. And it was a great weekend.
What kind of money did a second-round draft pick get back then?
Listen, I made $22.5 and I thought I was a jillionaire.
It was good money.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, because back then a teacher would make $10,000 or less. I mean, yes.
Probably six.
Yeah.
It's a little more unbalanced now, I would say.
Yes, it is.
It's. I was playing golf one time with a guy last summer, and he goes, "You know, you're just like Peyton Manning." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you know, you're a jillionaire." Just like, I said, "Wait a minute. I was a second round draft choice 43 years ago. Okay, made $22.5 million. I said, Peyton Manning makes more before the end of the first quarter of the first game of the year than I did in a career.
Yeah.
So it's all a little different. And Peyton Manning deserves every dime he makes. I mean, but that's just the way it is. That's the, you know, we had Nike throwing stuff in our locker, just trying to get people to use their product back then. So you didn't have ESPN and cable and the internet and all the, you know, the big time sponsors.
Yeah, there's probably just one game a week, maybe 2 games each Sunday on television.
Right.
You know, so for your family back home, they probably rarely saw you on television.
Got lucky to see a West Coast game maybe once or twice a year.
Yeah. What was the first thing you bought when you signed that contract? Anything stand out? Did you go out and buy a car? Or?
I bought a Grand Prix, a Pontiac Grand Prix with 8-track player in it. Some of the people listening to the shows don't even know what an 8-track is.
They could ask their dads.
It had a vinyl top.
Yeah.
I think it had a sunroof.
There you go. You're tooling around San Francisco.
Yeah.
A 49er.
Yeah, I think the second car I bought was a Datsun 240Z. I wish I had that car back.
Those are good cars.
Yeah, it was it was a neat little car. Of course, Datsun now is Nissan, and make a good product.
Any good stories from your times with the 49ers? Like when you got together with these guys recently, what stories came up that might be funny to hear today? Anything?
Well, it's amazing after 43 years how the stories get elevated to, the memory is kind of gone, so some people exaggerate some of the stories a little bit. You know, not really. There weren't any, it was just good to see everybody. Back in the off season back then, most of us had a job. We worked. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We also had a 49er basketball team. Of course, I enjoyed
doing that. Oh, I bet. You had to be the star of that team.
Well, I don't know if I was the star, but it was a lot of fun. We'd play the Raiders or we'd play the Rams. We'd go down. And usually it was for a school function, and they were raising money for the band or the school. And we'd play one another. Or if a school wanted to put their faculty up against us, we'd go play. So we played 50 games in the off season.
Oh, wow.
And that was a lot of fun.
So you lived out there in the off season?
Yes.
What was your job? What did you do?
I worked for the March of Dimes. And I went around and raised money. And they didn't do walks back then, but they might have some type of fundraiser that I was involved with.
So you did sign with the Hawaiians at the World Football League. I guess they just came to you with the money, right? Was that what it came down to?
Well, that and our Mike Giddings was a linebacker coach with the 49ers back then, and he was the head coach over there. So Ted Kwolek had been all pro, and myself and Jim Snidecki, who played with me at IU and who was on the 49ers, we all signed. Actually, they signed Calvin Hill and a couple other guys. They didn't go that year. The NFL was on strike that year. I got traded to the Bears and then got cut from there. So I joined the Hawaiian team about five games into the season and met them in Portland, Oregon. The Portland Storm was the name of the team. And we were the Hawaiian Hawaiians.
What did the uniforms look like?
I could only imagine. Brown and yellow with kind of a Hawaiian crest on the side of it. Okay. But there were some good players. Vinny Clements from the New York Giants. Randy Johnson had played quarterback with Atlanta and the New York Giants. Snidecki. What happened was once the NFL started again, the guys that were going to the World Football League, they cut them loose. And because what had happened is because of that, we doubled everybody's salary in the NFL to keep them around.
Yeah.
Because Zonka, Kick, and Warfield had signed to go to Memphis.
They're on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
And didn't go that year. Matter of fact, Zonka got traded to the New York Giants. I'm not sure where Kick went, or Paul Warfield probably stayed with the Dolphins. But they had a personal service contract with Sam Bassett, who owned the Memphis team, and Bassett Furniture out of Canada. So I think they got paid. I still have deferred compensation over in the island somewhere. I don't know. Maybe it's buried somewhere.
You never really got paid what you were owed?
No.
What was the contract for? What were you supposed to get paid?
$60,000.
Well, that would have been great.
Yeah. Now, I did get a bonus, so the bonus did go in the bank.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Like you say, though, you did raise salaries for the NFL. Back then, there were so few NFL and NBA teams that there was a market for other leagues. And the ABA lasted for 9 years, and the WFL and other leagues came along later. I mean, there was a need for them, really.
I think mid-'80s, then you had the USFL.
Right.
That's where Steve Young and Herschel Walker and those guys. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that again elevated salaries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's the marketplace.
Right.
You retired in 74. Were you just done at that time? Had you had enough, or was there another reason?
Well, I actually went to the Redskin camp because George Allen back then liked veterans. And, and Bill Malinchek, who had played ahead of me at Indiana and was a first-round draft choice of the Detroit Lions, he was also there. But they still had Charlie Taylor and Roy Jefferson and Frank Grant, and they had receivers. Now, Sonny Jurgensen and Billy Kilmer was still the quarterbacks, and made it till the end of training camp. And then once I got cut, then I came back to Indianapolis and was a stockbroker.
Okay. How long did you do that?
A couple years. Yeah. Then I went in the printing business for a couple years, and then I was in the medical field. I worked for a company Lilly owned out of La Jolla, California for about 15 years.
Eisenbarger reflects on John Pont's career at IU. and on the physical toll of all those years in football. But first, another Eisenbarger highlight. So far, we've had him catching a pass, we've had him returning a kickoff, and we've had him running the ball. Here he is, punting in the Rose Bowl.
Eisenbarger standing back at his own 28-yard line in punt formation. A high snap from center, but Eisenbarger delivers a good kick that is fielded by Mike Battle at the 17. He's up to the 20, the 25, still on his feet at the 30, and he's rolled to the ground near the Trojan 33-yard line. The tackle was made by Roger Grove, the second-string Indiana fullback. That was a 44-yard punt by Eisenbarger and a return of 18 yards by Mike Battle.
We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former IU football star John Eisenbarger. John Pont's coaching career didn't end well at IU, and Eisenbarger can't help but wonder how it would have turned out under different circumstances. One thing's for sure, though, his football career turned out okay. And thankfully, he can still remember all of it. If not for that boycott we talked about, would John Pont have kept it going at Indiana, you think?
I think he would have. I think that was a turning point that really hurt the program.
Yeah.
And then he went up to Northwestern and was a coach up there and then an AD. He went to Mount St. Joseph in Cincinnati and started a football program at one time. And then he actually went to Japan and coached. In his later years, he coached football over there. And basically it was, well, if you work for Toyota or one of the major companies, that's who your team was. You know, the people that worked at Toyota, let's just say, were made up of everybody who worked there.
Yeah.
And they had a fall and a spring schedule. And at one time, I remember he sent an article, and he was, one of the celebrities along with the sumo wrestler.
So you stayed in touch with him over the years, huh?
Yeah. He passed away several years ago, which is— Doug Cruzan and I both went over to the funeral, and of course he was a Miami of Ohio player and coach. And I mean, here at the funeral you had Bill Mallory and Ara Parsegian and Heppner at the time, and just a lot of the cradle of coaches. That was Miami.
What was it about him that made him successful?
Well, he was a fiery Spaniard, and I just think he treated everybody the same, at least what I saw. He was actually doing wind sprints with us when we'd have to run, 15-40s at the end of practice. He's trying to beat people. And at that time, he was 38 years old. We were 20 and 21. But he had a big heart. He was just good, a really good person.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a certain charisma about him. He televised well.
Right.
Came across well to the media, certainly. There's a lot of talk today about concussions, for football players. You seem to have done okay, weathered the storms. But do you see some teammates or guys that you played pro ball with maybe who have suffered from that?
And Doug Cruzan, being on two Super Bowl teams, sees it a lot more than I do because that 72 team is still never lost a pro game. They're still the most, undefeated team. Yeah. As a matter of fact, he was just at an autograph session up in Chicago and saw some of them, but some of the guys off that team, have had dementia and Alzheimer's and, aren't doing well. I had several concussions playing pro ball, and, they'd put the finger up in front of you, and if your eyes could follow the finger, they'd say, go back in. Well, the NFL had a big settlement, and everybody thinks, well, they gave $700 million or something. Well, that's all good on paper, but that's over a long period of time, 20 years. Now, they are going to pay for you to get tested cognitively about, and see. There's just, I don't know if you saw, there was a documentary done by a guy called League of Denial that was on one of the cable stations, and it was really well done, documented. I mean, the NFL had a doctor in New York appointed by Tagliabue, I think, that was his own personal doctor. And he was, I'm going to say, a dermatologist. I'm not sure exactly what he was, but he sure wasn't a spine guy or a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. And actually, part of that documentary was about him. And 20 guys have sent their brains that have had, Dave Durison and Junior Seau. And I think 19 out of the 20 have what's called CTE, which means you've got, brain damage from concussions.
Mm-hmm.
But because of this settlement, the NFL had to admit to zero, nothing. And so they made this settlement. And, it's interesting, though, in the paper today, I see the National Hockey League players have just had a concussion lawsuit filed.
So do you get money from the NFL as a former player because of this settlement? Or?
No.
Okay.
No.
But can you go and get an examination on
you can
on their
do
dime,
that.
Basically?
Yes, you can do that.
Yeah.
And they'll pay for testing. And that's why, Mark, I'm going to call you Bob right now, because that way you can be the witness to me that I didn't remember your name.
Sounds like Jack Mollenkopf might have had some of that.
Yeah.
Calling everybody by the wrong name.
Yeah.
Maybe he had a concussion. But it does seem, though, like a lot of pro football players back in the day were kind of treated like slabs of meat. The team doctor would just roll you right back out there, and you just played.
Well, if you saw the helmets we wore back, I was a little ahead of the leather helmet with no face mask, but if you saw the helmets we had, and I've got mine at home that I played at IU, it was a, Rydell plastic with just a webbing on top. There was no padding at all. The only padding was right around around your ears.
Yeah.
And so, but the joke was back then, if you'd go up and, pop a guy in his helmet, it was like an echo chamber in there. I see guys going up and hitting people in the head with their helmet all the time. Now, you wouldn't want to do that with the ones we wore.
You must feel grateful just you got your wits about you. You're not limping around. You played all that football, played pro football too, and your body is still good. So you must feel grateful just for that.
Pretty good. I've had both knees scoped, a separated shoulder. I had spine surgery. I had a carotid endarterectomy. I had carpal tunnel. So I've had a few things.
I guess I shouldn't have brought that up.
Well, no, but it's I'm 65 years old too, so some of that I think is age. And,
yeah.
But you're right. I was lucky. I carried the ball a lot of times in college, but was lucky to come and. I don't remember. I think I saw stars. If you see stars, you had a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times they'll just put you right back in there if you,
Yeah.
I mean, Michigan State, my sophomore year, knocked me out of the game for a while. And then I ended up scoring the last touchdown and we went 14-3. That was when we were 8-0 my sophomore year. I was, mm-hmm. But I was lucky. I did you see some of the hits today? And, and they're trying to protect people, and they talk about, guys that, are using your helmet. Well, back when we played, if you were a defensive back or anybody on defense, you led with your head and wrapped with your arms. So, today you've got running backs that they duck their head down and ended up with you as a defensive person hitting them in the head. I just don't see it. There's just going to be a lot of calls by the refs that, it's a judgment call.
One-on-one with John Eisenbarger returns in a moment. Okay, thanks to John Eisenbarger for donating to the one-on-one cause. As I reviewed this episode, it seemed to me there was a lot more that I could have asked him about. I don't think I've had anyone on this show who was the MVP of three sports as both a junior and senior in high school. and he certainly ranks as one of the greatest football players ever to come out of IU. No jokes, please. There really have been some great ones. Above all else, though, he can be grateful that he still has his wits about him. He took a lot of hits carrying and catching the ball in the Big Ten and the NFL while wearing those cheap plastic helmets, so just being able to remember his career is a victory now. And speaking of now, if you want to hear this or any of the other episodes with Indiana sports personalities, they're all on the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on one-on-one, click on the podcast link, and hours of informative, entertaining conversations await you. I can be reached by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I can be found on Facebook and Twitter, with the Twitter handle being at Mark Monteith. And I'll be back again next week with yet another spine tingler, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.